Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Over 4,800 reporters from 65 countries are in Hamburg, Germany, covering the G20 conference. Last night, anti-capitalist protesters across the city took to the streets as leaders from the world's 20 largest economies arrived. There were many clashes with riot police. In fact, there are 20,000 police and massive tanks on the streets. So, with so many reporters in town, what should we expect from the coverage? Well, so far, most of the coverage is about Donald Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin this morning. But what about inequality, climate change, and other pressing issues? Joining us to talk about the summit and media coverage is Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Hi, Scott. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you, Scott. As we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable, we start off on a positive note and highlight good journalism. You are very active on social media, posting lots of articles on a regular basis. What really caught your attention this week?
Well, I think there were a lot of good pieces in connection with the lead up to the G20. But I think I would give it to an investigative piece that was done by Tom Burgess in the Financial Times, which is taking another very deep dive into the flow of money into Trump projects, real estate projects, after 2004. Hmm. And I think he's done a very, very impressive job of showing how money came from kleptocrats in the former Soviet Union in the hundreds of millions of dollars into a particular project based in Manhattan. And he's describing how a former Russian mobster named Felix Sater was instrumental in collecting and bringing the money in, and how he now seems perhaps to have turned on his masters and perhaps is cooperating with an investigation. So we've got another case of a potential cooperating witness.
Wow. Scott, what are your thoughts overall on reporting about conflicts of interest and just Trump's very long financial trail and who he's connected to?
I think part of the problem is that there's so much of it. It's difficult to pull in and deal with, and it takes so much investigative work and time to pull out to fully understand it. And I've talked to quite a few journalists who've been dealing with, as with Mr. Burgess, dealing with this real estate project, too. These projects are not... there's not a good public record of them. It takes a tremendous amount of time and research to unfold what happened. And in the conflicts area, also, you're dealing with projects where there's very, very little public record. It's and plowing through with a real estate community figures who don't like to share information, and getting the facts behind what occurred is a huge investment. And I think just in the area of what's been going on in the Persian Gulf recently, where we have a tilt by the president that's contrary to the position taken by his own Defense Department and State Department, and there seems to be a pretty clear connection between Trump family business interests and the Emirates. But getting to the bottom of all that, and I've talked to several journalists who are working on it, it's taking a long time. It's very difficult to do.
Well, and as you said, it takes resources and money, and unfortunately, we are continually see layoffs at media outlets across the country.
That's exactly right. And I think most major media in the U.S., they prefer to go with opinion journalism, having talking heads who express opinions. That's cheap and that's easy, but it doesn't provide the deep reach information that we need to really form good, well-grounded opinions about these things.
And Scott, since you keep such a close eye on the media, what are your go-to sources at a time when there's so much focus on Washington, D.C.?
Well, I actually look at a lot of media outside of the U.S. I mean, and I just mentioned the Financial Times. I mean, I'm a very, very big fan of that newspaper. And in fact, it puts tremendous resources in getting basic business facts and figures right and avoids political opinion, which I think is a tremendous resource. But I think in a lot of the matters that are evolving today, you know, it's actually a great period again for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. Those three papers in the United States are breaking huge and important stories as stories at a pace we haven't seen in a long time.
Well, let's dive in and talk about what's happening in Hamburg, Germany. The G20 summit has kicked off. 4,800 reporters from 65 countries are covering this conference. There have already been massive anti-capitalist protests. A lot of police are on the streets, 20,000 police, the largest amount in Germany's history, and massive tanks on the streets. Before talking about what's expected to happen there, can you give us a brief history of the G20 and talk about why it was created in the first place?
Well, the G20 has been a platform, and it goes back more than 20 years now, 30 years. It's been a platform for the important the finance and economic center governments around the world to get together and try to coordinate their policy. So it's always had a heavy focus on trade and tax policies, ensuring that governments are able to raise their tax revenues, trying to iron out conflicts that arise between them on intellectual property issues, for instance, and on preferential trade dealings. So those have always been high points. More recently, there's been a consistent focus on the environment and climate change. And I think in the last three G20 and G7 summits, that's probably been the lead issues. And the leadership rotates every year. We have a different host. That host has responsibility for taking the lead and forming the agenda putting together a concluding statement, which dictates whether it's a success or not. But I'd say quite apart from that, in fact, the U.S. has, for the last 20 years, really been the leading force behind all of these summits and prefigured what occurs at them. And this year we see a stark transition, because the role of the U.S. is feeble. In fact, the U.S. is viewed as the distinct outsider.
And also, we should point out that these are leaders from the world's 20 largest economies. You pointed out the importance of climate change, and Oxfam notes that the G20 represents about 80% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But can you elaborate on what you just said there, Scott, about the role that the United States used to play and the role that it plays today at this summit?
Well, that's right. In fact, particularly you look at the German media over the last 48 hours, and they say, you know, prior American presidents, Democrats or Republicans, really had a hand on the steering wheel from the beginning throughout the process in dictating the agenda and prefiguring the outcomes of these summits. This year, Donald Trump and his White House couldn't get it together to reserve hotel rooms in Hamburg. They didn't do that. They had almost no role whatsoever in the preparation of the agenda. And they were busy in the month before the summit actually taking pot shots at the entire process, laying plans for a trade war with China and another with the European Union. So this year, the major focus of the leaders of the G20, it's not the leaders' leadership has not included the United States, and the major focus of the leaders has been to limit the potential damage coming from the United States and ensure that they could actually get to a communique in the end that embraced the most important issues, even in the face of expected obstruction coming from Trump, especially on the climate issue.
What strikes you about how foreign media are covering this? There was a piece in the Deutsche Welle newspaper, the German newspaper, arguing that this could mark the end of U.S. hegemony.
That's exactly right. I mean, I think, you know, if you look at the press in Britain, France, Germany, Italy, also Japan, and other East European states, that's the the principal note that's being struck. It's being said that, you know, Angela Merkel, of course, she is the host, and so she has a particularly important convening and guiding role for this summit. But beyond that, she and the German government really have stepped into a sort of void and become the Western leaders. So, you know, what's going on to drive this process forward is a coordination which has as its core her agreements being fixed with the major European allies and Japan. That's really now become the core of this group, and attempting to limit the damage from Trump and Putin. And I think generally she's getting high marks for this, and people are thankful for it.
Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. And Scott will be with us for another 15 minutes talking about media coverage of the G20 summit. This morning, there was so much attention about Donald Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin. Scott, you've probably seen the video. Social media is just going crazy with this video. It's Donald Trump giving Vladimir Putin a friendly handshake and then patting him on the back. How do you think the media should cover this meeting?
Yeah, there's an awful lot of attention given to Donald Trump handshakes. And it's become sort of an arcane art in understanding his relationships. And maybe there's a lot to it or not, because just the day before he was in Warsaw and made headlines both for a speech he delivered, but also for not shaking the hand of the president's wife in Warsaw. And that's a sort of strange encounter that's occurred with many of these leaders. But there really should be less of a focus on handshakes, hand grips, and pats on the back, and more on the substance of the discussions between them. So the really far more important hint we have about what was going on there was Trump's tweets and his statements about the Russia scandal relating to the 2016 election. So we saw considerable backtracking, where he had to embrace the view of the intelligence community, but then he lands in Hamburg and he's announcing that, well, the American intelligence community isn't necessarily of one view about what happened or about Russia's responsibility. So he seems to be pulling back from all of this, and again suggesting that we don't really know who did this. It could be someone else. So, you know, I think there's been a lot of focus on how he would address that issue. Would he address it firmly? Would he express America's concerns about the interventions that occur and determination to stop them in the future? And I think the signal we saw early in the day was clearly a pullback from that.
Well, if you'd like to join us and talk about media coverage of this meeting and also the G20 summit, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also tweet at Your Call Radio, or you can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. Scott, with this 24/7 news cycle, we move on so quickly. But let's talk about Donald Trump's trip to Warsaw, Poland. He arrived there on Wednesday night, meeting with the right-wing government there. And Laura King from the LA Times writes, U.S. allies in Western Europe worry that Donald Trump's visit is in effect stamping a seal of approval on the Polish leadership's aggressive moves against democratic institutions such as the courts and the news media, and that Trump could be seen as offering an implicit endorsement of the government's populist, stridently anti-immigrant stance, which is reminiscent in some ways of his own. And then over at Vox, there's a piece called Trump's speech in Poland sounded like an alt-right manifesto. And it says, in Warsaw, Donald Trump issued a battle cry for family, for freedom, for country, and for God in a speech that resorted to rhetorical conceits typically used by the European and the American alt-right. It was drafted by Stephen Miller, the architect of the travel ban. So let's talk about media coverage of his trip there and what it tells us and reinforces about his thinking.
Well, I think, Rose, you've absolutely picked out the two big issues from the meeting in Warsaw. So the first, which really concerns all the other European leaders, is Poland's relationship with the EU? And is Trump going to support the EU as an institution, or is he going to support the centrifugal forces within the EU seeking to crack it open and pursue different routes? And Poland raises this fundamental question of a rule of law state, independence of the judiciary, and independence of the press, because we have a right-wing government in Poland that has clamped down on independent media, especially broadcast media across the country, and that has stripped away rights and due process and limited the freedom and independence of the courts. It's a pretty radical scenario. In fact, we've seen that both in Poland and in Hungary. And the European leaders have been very concerned about it, and they've put a lot of pressure on Warsaw over it. And the suspicion, I mean, certainly we don't have full readouts of these meetings, but the reports that have appeared in European newspapers, appeared early this morning, suggested that European leaders were convinced that Trump was encouraging the government of Poland to disregard all the rule of law and human rights issues that were being raised by the European leadership, and was assuring this government it was going to have his support even if it took an anti-European path. So that was a rather, that was a very distinctly hostile thing to do in advance of the G20. And then the second thing is the public speech he gave, and that public speech was, I mean, I suppose you could say it projected a sweeping vision. It projected a vision of the West. Now, but this is a vision of the West that needed to stick together. It was a vision of a West that was white, Christian, and Northern European. And I think, you know, the Poles have had a certain historical experience with that vision. So that's a conceptualization that matches things that happened in Germany in the 1920s and 1930s. And I suppose you could say, you know, it's consistent with the Nazi view. So fascism is a part of that view of Western civilization, but also others. The cultural conservatives like Oswald Spengler, who wrote The Decline of the West, and, you know, the thinking of Spengler is reflected repeatedly in this speech. Now, all these people were horrendously anti-Semitic and also anti-Polish. So to give a speech echoing those thoughts and Warsaw was a very strange move to make, and then to do it without taking the visit that had been suggested to the Warsaw ghetto, also a disturbing move by Donald Trump.
Why do you think this isn't getting more scrutiny in the media in the U.S.? The Washington Post, Jonathan Capehart, did write an op-ed piece called Trump's White Nationalist Dog Whistles in Warsaw, but it feels like, just glancing at the major papers in the last couple days, that this got attention in the op-ed section, but not so much in the news section.
I think a lot of the news reporting didn't reach into sort of these currents of intellectual history and intellectual thought. It's rather a deep reach to expect of them. I would really expect much more of it to be in the editorial pages. But it's featured very prominently in the press in Europe reporting on it. I think there people have clear memories of these things and long memories, and they see the dog whistles, as Jonathan Capehart called them. But, you know, give it a few more days. I think we'll see more discussion of this in the U.S. media as well.
Let's talk a little bit more about the G20 summit. Donald Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin went longer than expected, and they missed the climate change meeting. They were not there. And I wanted to ask you about this because The Guardian has a piece about a new report finding that the G20 nations provide four times more public financing to fossil fuels than to renewable energy. And so many of these leaders, you know, like to talk about taking on climate change and embracing renewable energy. But Nicole Geo of the Sierra Club, one of the groups that compiled this report, said when these countries committed to the Paris Agreement, they made a pact with the world that they would take meaningful steps to reduce their carbon emissions. As we now know, these countries have been talking out of both sides of their mouths. It's unconscionable that any nation would continue to waste public funds on fossil fuels when clean energy sources are readily available.
As a group, this is true. I don't think their going 2 hours and 20 minutes was an oversight. I never expected them to make the climate change meeting. These are the two outsiders in that whole process. I think Putin's view is, you know, he'll embrace and sign the accords and say good things. He's never going to seriously make an effort to bring Russia into compliance with the Paris guidelines. And Donald Trump is, you know, even more ostentatious in his views on this. But let's compare that with what's going on in Europe right now. So we have headlines in the week leading up to this summit pointing out that Volvo, the largest Nordic producer of automobiles, is going to all electric vehicles within the next generation. We have Nicolas Hulot, the new Minister of Environment in France, announcing yesterday that by 2040, France would not have internal combustion engines. It would also be all electric in its transportation movement. We have Germany really being the showcase in diversification of its energy away from fossil fuel sources to wind, solar, and other systems. So there's actually a very determined effort being made in Europe, and it is accelerating. And it's the two countries on the perimeter. It's the U.S. And Russia right now that are the problem cases.
And then what about all of the protesters out on the streets, a lot of anti-capitalist protesters? Oxfam has a release called "Is This the Year the G20 Gets Serious About Inequality?" pointing out that eight men own the same wealth as half of the world, including Jeff Bezos of Amazon, Warren Buffett, Mark Zuckerberg, Larry Ellison, Michael Bloomberg. What about this issue of inequality, Scott, and how this is being covered or not covered?
It's very important that we have the protesters there raising that, in my view, because this is what gives globalization a bad name. That is, you know, it's certain elites that have benefited much more from globalization than others, and it's you know, the rights of workers in particular that have suffered, as well as the indigenous people in the developing world. So those issues need to be forced onto the agenda, and the leaders need to be forced to confront them. And I think in Germany, in fact, you even heard Merkel and her justice minister today saying, you know, we don't approve of the violence, but the voice of these protesters is necessary. We need them. And we see a lot of jokes in Germany that this year the police are out in force. They're usually there suppressing anarchists. But this year they're there to protect the anarchists because, of course, anarchist number one is identified as Donald Trump.
Well, it's just still incredible when you see this headline that eight men own the same wealth as half of the world.
And it's continuing to concentrate.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is the tendency globally towards the 1%. The country where this trend is most pronounced in the entire world is Vladimir Putin's Russia, where the concentration of wealth in the hands of the 1% has proceeded much more rapidly than anywhere else. I mean, we actually have other countries with worse numbers, Mexico, for instance. But as a trend, it's not only happening, it's accelerating.
Scott Horton is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. And we've been talking about media coverage of the G20 summit. Coming up after the break, we will talk about North Korea and then talk about Donald Trump's ongoing war on the media. This one is hard to ignore, but how do we add actual substance to it? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KLW, local public radio. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be asked, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio. Coming up at 11, it's Inflection Point with host Lauren Schiller. Stay with us.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll speak with historian Nancy McLean about her new book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. She tells the story of the economist James McGill Buchanan, who played a key role in the rise of the radical right. She says without his ideas and money from the Koch brothers, the hardcore libertarian right would not have succeeded in taking over the Republican Party. This is such an important book. I hope you can join us for that on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. Today, we're joined by Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. And now I would like to welcome Matt Taibbi back to the show. Matt is an award-winning journalist with Rolling Stone and author of the book Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. Hey, Matt, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. I want to ask you about the piece you recently wrote about North Korea for Rolling Stone. Donald Trump is becoming, well, let's just use the word, more belligerent in his rhetoric about North Korea. He says he's threatened North Korea with, quote, severe things. And, you know, what are your thoughts on how the media are covering this?
Well, I mean, I think I haven't seen that the coverage on North Korea has been bad. I think everyone's appropriately concerned. You know, the central point that I hear when I talk to people about North Korea is that, you know, something has to give in our position in terms of eliminating preconditions before we sit down at the table with the North Korean regime, and that Trump is exactly the wrong person to do that because that's exactly not in his personality. And so the likelihood that the situation is going to improve is minimal. But I haven't seen undue optimism in the press lately. I'm not sure what the issue would be.
And your piece is North Korea is not the only rogue nuclear state. Nuclear weapons are about to be made illegal worldwide, but good luck hearing about it at home.
Right. Yeah, there's a new treaty ban, which would be very similar to the International Landmine Treaty. It's very likely to pass. It has the support of 132 nations in the U.N., and it's a reaction to a perception by the non-nuclear parties who were signatories to the original nuclear non-proliferation treaty, which has a very specific provision in it, Article 6, which says that the nuclear power should make a sincere effort to themselves disarm. And because the nuclear powers have not done that, especially recently, especially since 2011, since the last U.S.-Russian New START treaty, there's been a complete lack of dialogue on that issue, and we're moving in the opposite direction with a trillion-dollar nuclear weapon modernization program. And because this is seen as a violation of the original bargain, a lot of the non-nuclear countries now want to institute this new ban, which would essentially make nuclear weapons illegal. Of course, that won't actually have any practical effect, but it's an expression of frustration.
Scott, how is this being covered in the European media?
I think there's appropriate attention to it and worry. And I think, the points that were just made are correct. So one of the major failings after the end of the Cold War was the failure to fully realize the peace dividend that should have come in terms of anti-proliferation, that is, reducing the nuclear stockpile of the U.S. And Russia. There was just a failure to follow through on that. That showed a real lack of vision on both sides, I think. And the problem has been addressed in the West, largely in terms of Iran and secondarily North Korea, but it's much broader than that. I think we're looking at proliferation going on involving a whole other tier of countries. So this is a huge headache for the world coming up, and it's not just North Korea, but North Korea is enough to be very worried.
What is the responsibility of the broadcast media in situations like this? I mean, we often have conversations about what the media have learned or not learned from the U.S. invasion of Iraq under the George W. administration. But what is their responsibility, you know, going beyond being a mouthpiece for politicians with tough rhetoric? What do you think, Scott?
Well, I think it's to not allow one simple development to monopolize all the coverage, so that there is an understanding of these issues in the broader context. But you know, I think the coverage has been good. I mean, I think there's certainly the major broadcast coverage of the North Korea issue. And the last couple of weeks has been very sober. It's been suggesting reviewing the options and making clear that none of these options are good options.
Matt, what are your thoughts?
I mean, I think it's there. We have a sort of built-in problem with the media in the United States, and when it comes to covering national security issues and the military. The military has a massive public relations budget, and not only are they very good at getting their own message out, but they have typically a very sympathetic ear in the major commercial networks, and also virtually the entire system of think tanks is sympathetic to sort of national security issues and the military. You know, you have groups like the Rand Institute and the Atlantic Council, and whenever journalists want to do a story, they're typically getting a quote from the military. Mm-hmm. And then they're calling up, you know, some analyst who works for a conservative or pro-military think tank who's telling him or her what the situation is. And so you typically only get one side of the story when it comes to any international issue that involves the United States and the armed services. And that's, you know, sometimes that's okay, because sometimes they're telling the whole truth, but sometimes in cases like the Iraq War, reporters can end up just flying blind because they're not searching around for an alternative point of view. They're not going the extra distance to find out what people on the ground in the other countries are thinking. And so this is kind of a danger area for us in the States.
And oftentimes when think tanks, people from think tanks are on the radio or television, for example, you rarely, if ever, learn about how these think tanks are funded, which is such an important part of the story.
Oh, of course. Yeah, you know, you don't know where they're funded. You don't know very often what the person's history is. You know, you remember during the run up to the Iraq War, the networks all hired a series of analysts who formerly had titles as, you know, either analysts or fellows at various research institutes, but a lot of them were graduates from either the Pentagon or from one of the intelligence services. Or there were former generals, and they were virtually all saying the same thing, that, you know, that we had to go in. When you're calling up a think tank, you know, as a reporter, you know what you're getting, because most of the time you know who these people are. But you're very often, when we say, oh, this or that analyst from an institute says we should do this, we don't go into the background of what that think tank usually stands for.
Matt Taibbi is an award-winning journalist with Rolling Stone and author of the book Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. We had Matt on earlier this year to talk about that book. You can find it at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Scott Horton, contributing editor at Harper's and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. And it's our media roundtable. You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also tweet at yourcallradio. Radio or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Well, let's talk about how the media should deal with Donald Trump and his tweets. We're 6 months into the presidency, and sometimes when you wake up, I still ask myself, is this his account or is this a fake account? Last weekend, he went after his old, very close friends, Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski, who gave him nonstop coverage in the lead-up to the election. They're the co-hosts of MSNBC's Morning Joe. And then there was that recent video showing Donald Trump body-slamming a CNN logo. I mean, this is also surreal. Matt, what are your thoughts on this? Now there's a big debate in the media about how much attention should be paid to these tweets.
So I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I started writing about this early in the campaign last year. Donald Trump has a lot of media experience, both as a reality show producer and star, and as somebody who's been involved quite a lot over the years with pro wrestling. And he has an amazing talent of turning everybody in his orbit into either a reality character or like a WWE figure. And one of the things that he does over and over and over again with great success is provoke people into playing roles that he's carved out for them. And, you know, during the campaign, you know, he would insult somebody like Jeb Bush, and Bush would, you know, react, you know, self-righteously and try to defend himself, not understanding that, you know, with the audiences that Trump was targeting, if you ever watch pro wrestling, the thing that people love the most is to watch the sort of self-righteous good guy get whacked with a chair, you know? And Trump goads people into playing that role. He gets them upset, he ruffles their feathers, and there's nothing that he loves more than seeing a panel full of, you know, intellectuals from New York or Washington denouncing him and saying, oh, he's inciting violence against the media. Trump loves that. He's doing this on purpose. He's egging the reporters on, and I understand that it's totally inappropriate behavior, but he wins in these transactions. When he gets us to respond in this way with this kind of outrage, it's a net plus for him every single time, and it's too bad.
Scott, you also have to wonder what's going on behind the scenes, because a lot of people are wondering, is he doing this on his own? Does he have a team with him? Is this all calculated to distract from other issues? What are your thoughts on that?
At 6 o'clock in the morning when he issues the tweets, I don't think there's a team involved in them, but that's surprising, isn't it? You know, I mean, I think it's one thing, obviously, when he does these things during a political campaign, and another thing when he does them as president of the United States. I think, you know, the press has to pay attention to statements that are issued by the president. They can't be ignored. But on the other hand, I think we're maybe giving them too much weight. So I've been studying, certainly over the last 3 weeks, the tweets and messages he's put out relating to this current conflict in the Persian Gulf between the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the Emirates on one side and Qatar on the other, where his own Defense Department and State Department staked out a position as mediators, trying to quench the conflict that has arisen, and Trump then put out tweets repeatedly siding with the Saudis in connection with it, and confirming that he had spoken with the King of Saudi Arabia and understood his and agreed with his perspective on all this. But, you know, those tweets did not translate into policy or action by the government. So it just seems to me perhaps we're giving the tweets generally more media attention than they deserve. So they deserve attention if they actually reflect a decision that the government has taken or lead you to understand how the government is going to act. But that's not frequently not the case.
Scott Horton is a contributing editor at Harper's, and Matt Taibbi is an award-winning journalist with Rolling Stone. And let's hear from Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. My question for the guests is this. I wonder about Trump's, when Trump says something, for example, which he says a lot, like, believe me, at the end of things he says, and I noticed that the media ridicules him for this and says, well, he's a fool, look what he does, he's betraying, that he's lying. I wonder if it's much more intentional than that on his part, if he really doesn't care about the people who don't agree with him, and amongst the people who are on his side, that plants the seed subconsciously, believe me, for example.
All right, Matt Taibbi, what do you think?
It's a good question. I think you're right. Trump is playing to a certain audience, and a lot of the subtext of what he's doing, he's not necessarily trying to communicate a concrete message or talk about policy. He's just emotionally trying to put his adversaries on one side and him on another side. And so, you know, when in the case of the news media, you know, he'll say things like, they're the opposition party, they're weasels, they're out to get me. You know, when I covered him on the campaign, he would insult us constantly, and, you know, and he would say they're liars, they're out for, you know, they're doing fake news. And all that people get out of that is that, you know, the press is out to get him, and he's sort of pre-inoculating himself from criticism from the media, because whatever we do say, Trump has already told people in advance that we have it out for him. So he is trying to reinforce his own credibility with his audience more than anything else. I think you're right. That's his primary motivation.
What do you think, Scott?
Well, I think he's unique among modern American presidents in that he's not trying to build a majority or press towards a consensus. He wants to have a determined group of backers, his base, and he wants to hold them. And I think he's trying to inoculate himself against criticism with that particular group, and he seems to be remarkably successful at it. So it's an unusual strategy, but for the moment it seems to be working.
Matt, you wrote another piece for Rolling Stone called With CNN Flap, Media's Trump-Era Identity Crisis Continues, and you write about what happened with James O'Keefe. This is the guy who got that undercover footage from Planned Parenthood, which made headline news, and you report that CNN has confirmed the veracity of a tape showing hidden camera conversations between a James O'Keefe plant and a producer from CNN. John Bonifield, CNN producer, in the tape says the network has been focusing on the Russia story because, quote, it's ratings. And then he also says, quote, Trump is good for business right now, which we also heard from CBS CEO Les Moonves last year. And then the CNN producer said the higher-ups were ordered to return to the story after spending too long, a day and a half, covering the Paris Accords.
Right.
I mean, this kind of thing just reinforces so many people's perception about the media.
Absolutely, and people should be upset about it. I mean, the dirty little secret of the Trump era, dating back to the very beginning of this campaign, is that everybody started making money when Donald Trump became a factor in this race. It was a significant factor in him winning the nomination, certainly, because at the very outset of the race, when other politicians had to pay for their publicity, Donald Trump didn't, because we were giving him probably $1 billion worth of free publicity because he was getting us ratings in return. It was a symbiotic relationship. When we started editorializing heavily against him during the race against Hillary Clinton in the general election, you know, he was still getting a ton of publicity. He did not have a traditional ground game in the way that politicians usually do. He wasn't going out there, or at least his campaign wasn't going door to door and trying to get support. But what he was doing was he was doing rallies. He was basing his campaign on an intimate face-to-face strategy. And so that won him a lot of support. And now, you know, everybody's making money. Even though the campaign is over, traditionally ratings plummet at news organizations. But they've been up about 50%. Beginning with the election, and they haven't tailed off since then. So it's this remarkable anomaly, which shows that the news business is basically cutting into the to the market share of the entertainment business, which is a never-before-seen phenomenon in the news media.
Scott, James O'Keefe is that conservative who also took down Acorn, the organization that did incredible work for low-wage workers. I mean, this guy has pulled some horrific stunts. It's kind of amazing that, I mean, if you want to call it, if you want to use the term fake news, that's this guy. But it's amazing that people like John Bonifield, CNN producer, would still talk to someone who has connections with O'Keefe. Obviously, he didn't know it, but everyone now should know that whatever you say could be used against you.
Oh, absolutely, but you know, I think the core of the problem here it still is the corporatization of broadcast news media, and the fact that you know the sort of standards that have been applied, especially in the broadcast area since the 50s, seem to be fading. In favor of viewer share and audience share. That's a huge problem. And I think coupled with that is the move away from serious investigative journalism towards opinion journalism. Mm-hmm. I mean, the airwaves are just filled with opinion all the time.
Right.
And you know, that some of that's a good thing. I enjoy it. I appreciate it. But it seems to me we have much less investigative work today than we've had historically.
Well, and also, you know, Matt, I don't even really like doing these lengthy segments about Trump's tweets. I mean, we should be talking about healthcare inequality or all of the disability activists who've been arrested this week and last week across the country standing up for Medicaid. So how do you find a balance here? Because you can't ignore them.
Well, the problem is that people have to make money. They got to get paid. And if you work at a big commercial media organization, Trump equals money. There's no way around that. It's just a fact of life. You know, I looked at some amazing statistics recently. You know, polls show that the public has less confidence in the news media than it ever has before. We're at an all-time low right now. But at the same time, they're watching us more than ever. So what does that tell you? That tells you that people are consuming the news in a different way than they did before. They don't believe us as much, but they're watching more, and they're watching for a different reason. In other words, we've become entertainment. We've become an opinion factory. People tune in to have their own views reinforced. They're not being challenged by news broadcasters anymore. They're not being presented with difficult material. This is a radical change in the product that news companies are producing, and it's something that we should be paying a lot of attention to.
Scott, what do you think?
Well, I think that's exactly right. I mean, it's also the political segmentation of news coverage right now. I mean, that's something I think Roger Ailes largely engineered and introduced, and that's had a very profound impact on the entire profession in the U.S.
Will Bunch, a columnist with the Philadelphia Daily News, wrote a piece called Trump's War on CNN and the Media Just Got Really, Really Scary. And he says that what's scary about the feud between the White House and CNN is the idea that Trump and his administration could start pulling the levers of power within the federal government, the ability to regulate, tax, audit, and investigate, to bully CNN or other news organizations into favorable coverage of the president. Do either of you ever see this happening, Matt?
Well, look, presidents haven't had to break much of a sweat in the past to get favorable coverage from news networks. You know, frankly, if you look at the history of presidents and major networks, we've told lie after lie and had the networks be willing co-conspirators with the White House on a regular basis, dating, you know, the Iraq War being the most recent example. I think it would be very unusual to see an organization like CNN capitulate because of something like, I mean, I very much doubt you'd see an audit. There were a lot of people who did think that the resignations of those three people who were involved in that story, where they made a mistake, that was an attempt to mollify Trump. If that's true, that would be extremely egregious. If they actually believed in the story and either yanked it or denigrated it because they were afraid of a backlash from the White House or a lawsuit from Anthony Scaramucci, who was one of the targets of that story, That just shows a lack of backbone in that news organization, and I would hope that they would stand up to the president if it comes to that.
And just, you wrote about this in your piece, you write about the four CNN reporters who mistakenly reported that James Comey was expected in Senate testimony to dispute Trump's account that he was not a target of the FBI investigation. CNN was forced to issue a retraction after Comey testified, and then the opposite turned out to be true.
I mean, I think one of the things that happens is that, again, when ratings are so high, and especially this whole idea that Trump might be impeached at any moment, this has got people glued to the TV. And my personal theory on this is that what happens to reporters who work in big news organizations, when there are a lot of these sort of breaking scoops that dominate news cycles, they feel a little bit of pressure to come up with more scoops, and they miss a little bit more. I think in this atmosphere where ratings are so high and everybody's so desperate to keep those eyeballs glued to the screen, that's why you're seeing a lot of these mistakes. And there have been a lot in the last 6 months or so. There have been a number of stories, more than usual, where we're missing. And I think that's one of the things that Scott was talking about, is this sort of collapse in standards. We're moving away from the hardcore reporting and more towards this opinionizing. That's worrisome.
Scott, final thoughts. What are you hearing from journalists that you speak to about these issues?
I think there's a lot of worry out there about this. I think the suggestion that Trump would turn to regulatory tools to influence journalism, it's a huge issue. It's very, very important. And it's important because of the corporatization of coverage. So that means that corporate managers who do reach into the process much more frequently than in the past, they're very concerned about a merger and acquisition that's being put through. So the suggestion that that approval process will be used to influence content, that's extremely troubling, and it puts a chill over the entire process. It's completely outrageous, and there were very few people who stepped up and called him on it.
Scott Horton is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Lords of Secrecy, The National Security Elite and America's Stealth Warfare. Matt Taibbi is an award-winning journalist with Rolling Stone and author of Insane Clown President, Dispatches from the 2016 Circus. Matt and Scott, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Thank you. Coming up on Monday, we'll be joined by historian Nancy McLean to talk about her new book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America. She tells the story of the economist James McGill Buchanan, who played a key role in the rise of the radical right. She says without his ideas and money from the Koch brothers, the libertarian right would not have succeeded in taking over the Republican Party. This is such an important book, and I hope you can join us on Monday at 10 a.m. Your Call is produced here at KALW. You can listen to past shows and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.